From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Synonyms for retirement include departure, withdrawal, retreat, words that cast leaving work in something of a negative light. Well, that's not the connotation that retirement experts Helen Dennis and Bernice Bratter wanted from retirement. So they mashed together retirement with the word renewal and came up with Project Renewment, a way to create a future that's equal to or better than your past. Project Renewment targets the unique experience of first-generation career women, those who paved the way for the rest of us working outside the home. Today on the program, we learn more about Project Renewment and this new model for retirement. Plus, a best-selling novelist, Steve Barry, on writing and preserving history. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Women during the 1950s and 60s fought hard for the right to work outside the home. Now those career women are approaching retirement age. So what will retirement look like for women who are highly educated, successful, and in many ways have defined themselves by their achievement in the workplace? Today on the program, retirement expert Helen Dennis joins us to talk about a new model for retirement that she calls Project Renewment. And Helen Dennis, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Helen Dennis is a national expert in aging, retirement, and employment. She's written about aging for the Wall Street Journal. She was a delegate to the White House Conference on Aging, and she is co-author of the book Project Renewment, which addresses the unique issues of retiring women. She joins us from a studio in Manhattan Beach, California. Helen Dennis will present the lecture, The New Retirement, A Unique Time for Professional Women, on Friday, that's tomorrow, May 18th at 7 p.m., and the lecture will be at the Main City Library here in Salt Lake City. We'll have more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry will join us to talk about writing thrillers and preserving history. But first, Project Renewment. How much of your identity is wrapped up in your career? Are you looking forward to retirement with optimism or uncertainty? If you have questions or comments about the unique challenges retirement brings for working women, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Helen Dennis, you're an expert on aging and employment. What got you thinking about women and retirement?
Well, it actually began when my colleague, Bernice Bratter and co-author, called me with a question. And she said, has anything been written or has it even been on the radar screen about career women who have felt passionate about their work and how they look toward the future? And Bernice, who is an extremely professional and well put together woman, said, I'm just retiring from the Women's Foundation and I'm having a problem. So what's out there for women like me?
So this came from a personal experience.
It came from I certainly have interest in the broad issues of aging, but this really focused my attention that this is an area that's important. And her question was, do you have any interest? And I said, on two levels. One, professionally, because there really hasn't been anything addressed in the topic. And two, personally. You know, I am maturing and aging and a professional woman.
You say that this is the first and largest generation of women in history who have spent much of their adult lives in the workplace. Talk a little bit about this demographic shift.
Well, I should say this generation that's identifying this as an issue, we could call them the silent generation. We're not so silent anymore because we were the smallest cohort. But it was also a very active cohort that moved the women's movement forward and civil rights. And it's a first generation to really identify with their work so strongly. And there were increasing numbers. And because it's new, there were no role models. And you can't look to my mother's generation to figure out how to do it. So this is really a first, you know. And behind us, our 78 million boomer women, well, I would say about 40 million are women, many of whom have higher education and professions, who are going to be looking towards a future to say what's next. And I should also add, when we look at this, let's say, very leading edge of the boomer generation or the silence, they lived before and after the women's movement. And during the women's movement, women said, you know, is this all there is? These same women are now maturing in their 60s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, and say, wait a minute, I've had my career, which has been fabulous. I am a family woman, which has been terrific. I've engaged in my community, which is great. Now what? What is next? And that's really what this book focuses on, how to get there and how to define it for yourself.
Hmm. Historically, how have we retired? And I'm not just talking about women here, but I mean, the history of retirement seems to be an innovation of the Industrial Revolution. Is that when we started thinking about what retirement means and is?
Oh, exactly. And there was a push to get your older employees moving out to make room for the young ones. But there were certain assumptions. The assumptions were that if you are older, you really don't perform as well, and you may be rigid, and a lot of stereotypes are wrapped up with that. But now we have a whole new way of looking at retirement. I mean, it's not living on the periphery of life. This is men and women. With most people who look forward to that next chapter are not looking at a lesser life. Certainly economic security is key, but people are still looking for peak experiences. That's different. That's different from previous generations, and the opportunities are there.
Hmm. Helen Dennis, she is a national expert in aging, retirement, and employment, and her book is Project Renewment, which addresses the unique issues of retiring women. She'll present the lecture, The New Retirement, a Unique Time for Professional Women, tomorrow night at 7 here at the City Library in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join our conversation about retirement issues surrounding working women, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So I guess what is the differentiation between retirement for men and retirement for women? I mean, in some ways it must be different or you wouldn't have written this book.
Well, I would say that some of the goals and the values and the motivations may be similar. But how men and women get there, from my observation, is different. I've worked with over 10,000 employees preparing for what we call the non-financial aspects of their future. And this is an overgeneralization with many exceptions. But in general, men don't talk the same way as women. And again, this is at the risk of being slightly sexist. It's that women get to the issues faster. They will talk about the losses, the challenges, the ambivalence, the feelings. Men may get there, but I think they take a little longer to get there. And also, I think women are a little more communal, because in Project Renewment, women get together in small groups and talk about identity. What does productivity mean? Who am I without my business card, etc.? And so I think the goals may be similar, but the process and how one gets there is a little different between men and women.
Hmm. What does work mean for today's women? I mean, is it a challenge, or is it just a way to provide for the family? Is it status? What is work?
I think that's the unique part, because today we have more women who truly identify with their work. And not only that, people identify them with their work. So it's not only self-identity, but that's how people recognize you. And when you move to that next chapter and that identity is no longer with you, you say, well, who am I? Where do I fit? You know? So work has become increasingly important, particularly to career and professional women.
In your book, you note that the relationships that women form in the workplace can be are as deep as family connections in some ways. And you know, so when it's time to leave the office, it can hurt emotionally.
It can. And that can also be true for men, because we actually spend more time at work than we often do than with our families. And so they have to, one says, well, you know, who am I? I've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to create friendships outside the workplace. Well, when you leave the workplace, who was there for you?
You mentioned that money is part of the equation. Many women cannot afford to leave employment, but many others can. But they still have this sort of lingering worry in the back of their minds that, you know, they won't have enough cash in the bank to support themselves as they live longer. I mean, that's the fact. We are living longer, and they worry about financial security in later life.
They certainly do. But there are almost two aspects to that. One is the reality. Do I have enough money? But the other is, this is the first time in my 60 years, 50 years, that I don't have an income, that I'm not producing revenue, that I am drawing from my savings and my pension and my other sources of income. So that can be unsettling. In fact, some of our women said, it's not the amount of money, it's the fact I'm not earning money anymore. It's such a strange feeling. And I see that I'm drawing and not contributing. Mm. It's a new experience for many and somewhat unsettling.
You formed a group of women to explore some of these issues, and you combined these two words, retirement with renewal. Describe exactly what renewment is in your mind.
Well, renewment grew out of a dissatisfaction of some of our women to say, retirement just doesn't feel right. It just doesn't quite describe me. Renewment suggests vitality, rebirth, opportunity, something very positive, energetic, which doesn't seem to have the same feel to it as retirement. And renewment was an accident. You know, it's not something that we brainstormed. It just was kind of an accident speaking about retirement and renewal, and it came out renewment. And the women said, oh, my gosh, that's the word. I feel comfortable with that. And now we have people saying, you know, I'm in the renewment phase of my life. That shocked us. But apparently the word feels comfortable.
So this project renewment, you advocate forming groups. Is this group therapy for the women who need support in this transition of life?
No, and that's a really important distinction. You could call this almost a growth group. You know, we don't fix people, but it's for women who have had some influence over their past and want influence over their future, using their strength, their energy, their talent to create that next chapter. So the group also is not a traditional support group. However, it is supportive to one another. But it's much more a forum for discussion that is warm and friendly and kind, but it isn't a traditional support group and it is not therapy.
We're talking about Project Renewment, about retiring and women in retirement with the expert Helen Dennis. And she'll present the lecture, The New Retirement, A Unique Time for Professional Women, tomorrow night at 7 at the City Library in the main auditorium. That's 2nd East and 4th South here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us with your comments or questions about the transition to retirement, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, retirement expert Helen Dennis is with us talking about what retirement looks like for working women and how that's different in some ways from the experience men undergo. She's coined the phrase Project Renewment, a combination of retirement and renewal, as a new way to define what retirement looks like for the first generation of working women. And Helen Dennis is coming to town to present the lecture, The New Retirement, tomorrow night here at the City Library. We'll give you details on that as we go. But you can join us if you like. Does retirement excite you or fill you with anxiety? How can you make retirement less busy and more meaningful? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 or send email to cityviews at kcpw.org. Helen Dennis, in your book, you write about how some women retire and then they totally fill up their calendars with lunches and volunteer opportunities and appointments. And you call this the honeymoon phase of retirement.
Yes, and I guess quite honestly, I didn't coin the phrase. It's from sociologist Robert Atchley. There is a desire to have a very filled appointment book or calendar, to be busy. When you meet someone and they say, well, how is retirement? And the thing's, oh, I'm so busy, I don't know how I ever found time to work. But the real question is, are we busy with things that matter? Or are these just time fillers? And it raises a larger question, which is, what's really important to me now? You know, what makes a day a great day? And if I don't have the structure, and I don't have the people that I used to have around me, and I don't have the goals that I used to have. So busy is important, but we say, so the answer, busy too. But what are we busy with? And I think that's a real question that have to be defined by women themselves.
How do you find out what is not busyness, but fulfillment? How do you find what gives you that kind of inner meaning?
That's not magic. And in fact, sometime at the life stage, ending the first career, going on to the next chapter, that we have, it's a new time. We haven't really had a chance to even ask ourselves, what's really important now? Have our priorities changed? Am I going to live the life I truly want to live? And what do I have to do to make that happen? And a lot of that discussion happens within groups. That's a very rich dialogue. And sometimes it's easier to do that in dialogue than in isolation because it's a new kind of question. It may be something we asked ourselves at 22 or 23, but maybe we haven't asked ourselves that question for the past 40 or 45 years.
What is the trick with groups? Why do they work? I mean, why can't you just sit down and, you know, make a list of the things that make you happy and sort of self-evaluate? Why do you advocate for this kind of group process?
Well, if our being were only made up of intellect and logic, we could write a list and do a check, but we're made up of many components, and there is an emotional, psychological side to us. And in a group with what I call like-minded women, it doesn't mean you're from the same discipline or the same background, but the values and the aspirations may be similar. Something happens. There's a synergy. There is a connection that stimulates one's thinking. I can say every Project Renewment group, whether I help start a group or my own group, I walk away with a different thought. And it isn't because of my soul thinking. It's because I've listened, I've interacted, and I've learned something. So learning and self-awareness is all part of this group process. And I should also add, these women like each other. I mean, there's a real simpatico. And I'd like to add, I had one woman at 65 who said, you know, I never thought at my age I would be making best friends. You know, my best friends, really best friends, are from 20 and 30 years ago. But here I am in my mid-60s. I've made absolutely wonderful close friends. That was an unexpected outcome.
Speaking with Helen Dennis, the retirement expert, about this idea of renewment, a combination of retirement and renewal. Helen Dennis, what about your spouse? Say your significant other may be retiring before you do, or may have some expectations for you and your newfound freedom that you may not be aware of. Talk about how you negotiate personal relationships during retirement and maybe some of the wrinkles that women especially face.
Well, that is a new piece. And I can say because it's new, there are not a lot of established models. I mean, the literature says the ideal situation is if both mates retire at the same time. Probably the least desirable is if he retires first and she is going off to her work.
And why is that the least desirable?
I think it's because there might be some role changes. Now, he is at home, she is out, filled with a day of activity, and there are things to be done. There's grocery shopping, and there's the housekeeping, and there's the laundry, and there's the cooking. She may say, well, honey, you're home now, you have all this time, you can do it. And he can say, no, wait a minute, this is not what I signed up for. I'm not sure I want to do this, nor am I comfortable with it. So it's important to have a dialogue about who does what and the expectations. He may say, you know, I expected to have a playmate in my retirement years, and you're going off to the office. The important part is the dialogue. And the important part is to think about expectations, because this is something people don't even think about. But there are issues and there are concerns.
So relationships really do enter a new phase. And as women continue to work, and probably work a little bit longer, that can complicate things.
Yeah, and I think your point's well taken. They may work a little bit longer because their career path has been different. They may have left the workforce, stayed home to raise the children, then maybe went back to school and re-entered the workforce later. And just when she says, I finally am at this point in my career, I absolutely adore what I'm doing, and he says, honey, I just got an offer I can't turn down for early retirement. Well, there you are. He's ready and she's not.
What about the family dynamics? You know, when you enter into your 60s and 70s, start thinking about retirement, what are the family expectations? Because, you know, you may have grown children and some grandchildren to take care of, too.
Uh-huh. That is a good one. It could very well be that the adult children says, oh, my God, I'm thrilled. My mother is retiring and now I can absolutely count on her for carpooling, for helping out with the children. Without some recognition that maybe mother wants to reestablish a different kind of next chapter, would rather be on call than making a commitment of 3 days a week for childcare. And that raises the issue for women of balance. You know, how do you balance what's important for you beside the family with your family commitments? And I should say, grandparenting is just wonderful. I mean, it is more than you can even imagine. But is it at 100% responsibility? That women have to decide for themselves. But sometimes those and again, it's the expectations, and that's where dialogue is really important.
Again, speaking with Helen Dennis, the retirement expert, at what point do you know that it's time to hang it up? Is it from outside pressures in the office, or is it, you know, physically you're just more tired and you can't keep up the pace like you used to at the office? Is there the cultural pressures to be young and vital and energetic in a workplace setting?
I think it's all of those. But I think if when going to your lab or your office or your courtroom or your classroom, that it's no longer fun, that it's really a grind, there is a sign. The other is, are there some signs from the environment that it's not as friendly as it used to be? Well, and I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but aren't there laws in place, federal laws to protect against age discrimination?
No question about it. It is illegal to discriminate by age for anyone 40 and over in employment and retirement decisions. However, that doesn't mean that the environment will always be what we call age-friendly. There are many ways of discouraging older adults from the workplace that are subtle and sometimes not so subtle. It could be not being invited to a retreat, having your office moved, not being part of the distribution list of vital information. So I think one has to be one has to be able to afford to retire, and that is the keystone. But beyond that, I think it's important to be sensitive to the environment, what the messages are being sent, and then to yourself and say, if I have a choice right now, is this what I want to do with my life? And where am I in the life stage? I mean, if we say that, you know, at 65, a woman has on the average 20 more years of life ahead of her. You can say, is this how I want to spend my life? Am I really living the life I want? Am I looking at the options? And what's the next piece for me that can be, and I think this is the piece of renewment, that the future is not only as good as the past, but it can be even better.
Do you find that this is an easy transition? That in your experience, I believe that the group, the initial group that you formed, the Project Renewment Group in LA, I mean, met for a couple of years. Does it take about that long to sort of work out the kinks and feel comfortable in this new Renewment skin that you've got?
You know, everybody is different. Everyone is different. But I think we can agree that this is a transition. And for some, it takes a little longer than others. And it's an ongoing process, because what you decide is perfect for me today may change in 2 years. And I think that's the important thing, that this is not the end zone. This is an ongoing process for people particularly who are not pleased with the status quo, either for themselves or their community or society. It's ongoing.
This group that you found, you found that the ideal group size was about 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 women, I believe. Right. How do you find these women to sit down and kind of cogitate on some of the issues that go with Renewment?
Well, this is word of mouth, because Project Renewment is not really an organization or a nonprofit. It's a grassroots movement. And in fact, it has grown virally because we don't market. We have a website, projectrenewment.com, but we don't market this. And now we have about 25 groups that we know of, mostly in Southern California, but they're in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Boston, Florida. They have just grown up, and it's really grassroots. And maybe it's a topic that the time has come. Where people just feel connected to this issue and gather around and pull together like-minded women. I will say in Southern California, my colleague and co-author Bernice Bratter really developed a somewhat of a process where she invites a number of people to, quote, and I use this very loosely, to be interviewed, to make sure that women's expectations are really consistent with what Project Renewment is. For example, if one is depressed, really significantly depressed, that person may need a support group or therapy, not going to find the answers in Project Renewment. So it's important to look at, are the expectations aligned with what Project Renewment delivers?
And again, what are those expectations? What should they be? What is the goal?
That's a good question. The goal is, number one, to have a better understanding of oneself, to really look at the vast number of opportunities that are out there, and to really define what meaningful is at this life stage, and to expand oneself, to grow intellectually, to grow emotionally, to grow in relationships. And if that's a value of a woman, then that fits with Project Renewment. So it's constructive and productive change.
You say that, you know, this generation of working women is on the vanguard. This has never been done before in history, and so this is a new model of what retirement can look like. How do you think a generation or two down the line is going to approach retirement? Do you think it'll be different in any way?
Well, it depends how many years we think they're going to be in retirement. If people are going to work until 70, they may have a shorter period of time. Mm. But my guess is, with this particular cohort of women, I think the expectations will continue to be high for themselves, for their family, for their community.
Do you think retirement will be easier for women who have grown up in this environment where work is just a natural part of life?
Well, it depends how long they work. I still think, because it's such a dramatic change, that there will be subjects, concerns that will surface. And I do want to add, I mean, we're talking about this as women, for women, and up until now, I've always thought that men won't gravitate to this process. Well, our first number one group of Project Renewment women are going to be meeting with actually a male counterpart in Southern California called the Life Transition Group, made up about of 25 highly accomplished men who are discussing the same topic. That's new. And I think as boomers move forward more and more look at retirement, I think we're going to have more dialogue, not only among women, but also among men.
Do you see a time when men and women will sit down together and talk about these issues?
Well, odds you should say that, because in June, we're going to do that. We're going to sit with the men and our about 8 or 10 of our women, and we're going to talk about the issue of identity. And it'll be fascinating to see if men and women approach this in a similar way, a different way, if they're looking for different outcomes. So I'm really curious how that's going to go. So, I know it will be a positive one, but we don't know what the dialogue will be.
Interesting. Helen Dennis, you're a professional woman. Do you look forward to your own retirement? And you know, through this renewment process, what do you think your retirement is going to look like?
Well, I have to say I'm not retired. And I absolutely love my work. And what I look forward to in retirement is greater flexibility. And I have a fair amount of it now because I'm self-employed. But I would say greater flexibility, but I would always like to stay involved in my field. The field of aging is a growth industry, so to speak. So I look at more flexibility. I look at increasing time with grandchildren. And a time to really pursue something different, which I haven't done, something that is totally different from my past experience. So that's the extent with which I can see my future.
Helen Dennis, she's a national expert in aging, retirement, and employment. She's co-author of the book Project Renewment, and she'll be presenting the lecture, The New Retirement, A Unique Time for Professional Women, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock here in the main auditorium of the City Library. And if you have more questions, there are links on our website, kcpw.org. Helen Dennis, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next, Steve Barry on his novels and his support for historic preservation. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. With 14 million copies of his books in print worldwide, New York Times bestselling novelist Steve Barry creates thrillers steeped in history and detailed research. He loves history so much that he and his wife have created a foundation, History Matters, dedicated to historic preservation projects throughout the country. And today on the program, Barry is with us to discuss his passion for writing and preserving history. And Steve Barry joins us by phone from, I believe, a hotel room in California where you're on book tour. Steve Barry, thanks very much for your time today.
Great to be here. Yeah, I'm down in San Diego. I'll be coming your way in a couple of days.
Terrific. Steve Barry, of course, is the New York Times bestselling author. His books have been translated into 40 languages, sold in 51 countries. He's the founder, co-founder with his wife, Elizabeth, of History Matters Foundation. And he's written many bestsellers, including his newest novel, The Columbus Affair. And as Steve Barry mentioned, he'll be coming to Utah. I believe he's giving a lecture, a reading on his novel, The Columbus Affair, this Sunday at the Jewish Community Center. On Monday, he's offering a History Matters workshop to benefit the Utah Heritage Foundation. We'll give you details on both of those events as we go. But if you have questions or comments about Steve Barry's writing, about his work and his passion for history, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Steve Barry, your writing obviously appeals to millions of people, and yet on your website you write that your, quote, road to publishing was long and arduous, spanning 12 years and 85 rejections. So how did you finally get that big break?
Well, the world changed for me one day. You know, it took me 12 years from the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word. I had 85 rejections over 5 different manuscripts that were submitted to New York houses. Then the world changed. The Da Vinci Code was published, and it brought the international suspense thriller genre back to life, and it came back to life not as a spy thriller, but as action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings, and that was the very thing I was writing, and Random House was looking for stuff to go with Da Vinci Code, and so I caught my break thanks to that novel.
Did you know that you always wanted to be a writer?
Not really, no. I was a reader. I was a reader all my life. I didn't write my first word until I was 35 years old. Now, I had a little voice in my head that was driving me crazy for about 10 years. Every writer on the planet has the same little voice, and it was kind of nagging at me, and I ignored it. But then finally, I listened to it in 1990, but then it took, as I said, 12 years before I was able to get published.
Anyone who's read your thrillers knows that they involve a lot of history, and I really mean a lot. Why does history matter to you so much as a fiction writer?
Well, it's fascinating to me. I deal with some of the obscure stuff, things that are lost and forgotten. This new book deals with Christopher Columbus and something very unique and interesting about him that I dare say very few of the listeners know anything about. Last year with the Jefferson Key, I dealt with a clause in the United States Constitution that I think would shock most people to know it's there. The Library of Alexandria, the lost tomb of Alexander the Great, the first emperor's tomb of China, you know, Napoleon, Charlemagne. I find these things from the past that are very interesting, and I want to know more about them, and I'm hoping the reader wants to know more about them. And then I fashion a modern-day thriller, because I have to bring it current. You know, so what if those things are lost? What does it matter? Well, I have to make it matter today. And that's a lot of fun to put that together. I enjoyed the Columbus Affair a whole lot putting it together, because, as I said, I learned stuff about Christopher Columbus I never knew.
How did you find the nuggets? You know, in the Columbus Affair, you talk about symbols. You speculate about his lineage, about buried treasure in Jamaica. How do you find these little tidbits of historical fact, I guess, and integrate them and weave them into a storyline?
Well, the Columbus Affair was, the idea came when I stumbled across Simon Wiesenthal's book called Sails of Hope, which is a fascinating nonfiction book written about 40 years ago. And it's referenced in the back of the novel for folks who want to try to find it and read it. And Wiesenthal postulated a very interesting theory regarding Christopher Columbus that may very well be true. And in the 40 years since then, we've learned that just about everything we know about Christopher Columbus is not true. Most of it's just legend and wrong. And Wiesenthal's theory could very well be right. And so I took that and I started weaving a thriller around it and putting it together and coupling it with some real life facts, like that the Columbus family controlled the island of Jamaica for 150 years and refused to allow the Inquisition to come on board. When Columbus sailed, he had 87 men on board, and contrary to Hollywood, he didn't have a single priest on board those ships, not one. But he did take along with him a Hebrew translator. You know, why did he need a Hebrew translator? These are all very interesting questions that we deal with in the novel.
It's not just isolated to Columbus's experience, though. You write about the history of coffee in the Caribbean. You talk about violence between the Palestinians and the Israelis in the West Bank. I mean, it seems like you really try and bring historical tidbits all together into one storyline.
Yeah, I have to make a so what. What does it matter if there's a great secret associated with Christopher Columbus? Who cares? Well, it matters a lot, and I had to bring it forward to why that secret would matter today. And that all those elements you talk about are involved in there, particularly the Maroons, which are a very interesting group of people in Jamaica. They're the only slaves who actually fought and won their freedom. And I spent a couple of days down there in the Maroon country with them, and it's a fascinating place and a fascinating culture. So I incorporated all of that into the novel. And, you know, this novel goes from Florida to Vienna to Prague and then on to Jamaica. It's a great, you know, globe-trotting type of adventure. I think the readers will enjoy it. You know, it's my first standalone in 7 years. My recurring character, Cotton Malone, took a vacation this year. I've written 7 novels with Cotton, but he took the year off, and I've created this new character, Tom Sagan, this disgraced newspaper reporter who's about to end his life, and at the moment before he pulls the trigger, something happens that sends him off in this adventure. And, you know, it's just we're hoping that the standalone will attract some new readers, some folks who haven't discovered me, and give me a shot and hopefully like the story.
We're speaking with New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry. His latest novel, The Columbus Affair, he will be reading from that novel on Sunday, May 20th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Jewish Community Center here in Salt Lake City. He's also presenting a History Matters workshop to benefit the Utah Heritage Foundation, and that's happening on Monday, May 21st. We'll give you details on that as we go. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about Steve Barry's fiction, 801-355-TALK. Talk is our number, 801-355-8255. Steve Barry, the research that you pour into your novels, I imagine you rely on historical artifacts, on records. You have to visit sites in order to be able to make them come alive on the page. Talk about the research end of fiction writing.
I use about 400 sources to write a novel, so I read about 300 books on Christopher Columbus, and if you read 300 books on the same subject, you'd be shocked at how they conflict with one another so much. You get very little consistency between them. So I do a lot of book research, and then there were two trips, one to Prague and one to Jamaica, because I could not find what I was looking for in the book, so I had to go and find it on the ground. And so that's common to most books. It's 300 to 400 sources and usually at least one trip. You mentioned that writer's workshop in Salt Lake City. All your listeners out there that are writers, this is a heck of a 4 hours. You're basically going to learn in 4 hours what I learned in 12 years. You know, we're going to talk about story structure and point of view and dialogue and do's and don'ts and all kinds of things. And Elizabeth does an hour on the business of writing. And it's a heck of a 4 hours. We've taught 1,500 students around the country. They've all enjoyed it. All of the money that is raised that day from the entrance fee to the workshop will go to the Utah Heritage Foundation. Elizabeth and I, you know, we don't charge to come or expenses or anything. We donate our time. So you're going to be helping your local community and helping your craft at the same time. So we encourage all the writers out there, please come out and give it a shot.
Why are you so concerned about historic preservation? Where does this come from?
I was in Oregon a few years ago, and an archivist came up to me, and he told me something. He said, you know, you realize we have millions and millions of pages of documents and archives all around this country, and they're just stored away. And do you realize that every second of every day the ink fades off another page? And as the ink fades away, do you realize we can't read that anymore? We don't know what that says. We don't know what was there. What are we losing every second of every day? And that got me thinking. I said, wow, I never realized that. He's exactly right. And so that's why Elizabeth and I created History Matters, to try to help in our way. We've done about 25 History Matters projects around the country over the last couple of years. We've raised around $200,000 for various historic projects. We're hoping to help out the Utah Heritage Foundation with their efforts on Monday. And we're going to be doing some more of these around the country. I'm going to be going to Dallas and Houston, Kansas City, Des Moines, Iowa, New York City, and then we're doing a really cool one in October at the Smithsonian, where I'm going to be teaching, and those participants are going to get a tour of the rare book room of the Smithsonian as part of the workshop that day. So we're very passionate about the subject. We very much see a need for it, and it's a way for us to give back, and we've enjoyed doing it.
Is it just documents that are disintegrating, or are you concerned about some of the preservation efforts when it comes to buildings and art and artifacts?
Oh, no question. We've done History Matters events for buildings, artifacts, documents, books, land, cemeteries. We've done a wide variety of History Matters events. No, the deterioration to our historic objects is across the board. It's not limited to just one aspect. There is simply no money out there anymore for historic preservation. So we're going to have to find innovative ways to raise the money. And that's what History Matters does. An example, we did an event in California, and I raised $5,000 from a workshop one afternoon that we did. The great thing about the workshops, too, by the way, there's no overhead in them. I just need a room, and I'm ready to go. It doesn't cost the sponsor anything to make it happen, so it's just all profit for them to use for their project. We had $5,000, and I felt a little disappointed, but the organizers were ecstatic. I mean, they were just so happy. What it was is their 19th century Victorian building, which is their local museum, has a big hole in the roof, and they can't patch it. They didn't have the money, and it's destroying the building, and the $5,000 was going to patch the hole. And that building is now safe until they can get some more money in there to do what has to be done. So a little bit of money goes a long way in historic preservation.
Is money the big issue, or is there an interest level that you have to cultivate as well? I mean, you need to get this this idea of preserving our heritage, preserving history in people's minds before they start opening their wallets, right?
Oh, no question. History Matters does both of those. It's one thing that we do, like talking to you right now and other things like that. As we do press interviews and as we do things, we bring awareness to local historic projects. The Utah Heritage Foundation is doing a lot of work in your area, and we're going to bring some attention to that. We've done other interviews and other things in your area, and hopefully that will get some interest, and we may find that one person who will get really excited about it and come in and help make things happen. And that's what we try to do. It's not only money, it's interest as well, and History Matters serves both of those functions.
Speaking with the New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, and he will be coming to Utah again to do a reading from his latest novel, The Columbus Affair, this Sunday from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Jewish Community Center. And he'll be presenting a History Matters Writers Workshop to benefit the Utah Heritage Foundation on Monday. And if you'd like to join us or have any questions, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We'll put all the details about both of those events on our website, kcpw.org. Steve Barry, give us a sneak peek at some of the tips you'll be giving about writing and the process of writing. I guess first, because your research is so intensive, do you research first and then write, or do you start writing and developing those characters and the plot and then, you know, figure out what you don't know and then start researching? What's your technique?
I have to research the novel before I start writing it, and I do that while I'm writing the previous novel. So right now I'm writing next year's novel, 2013, and while I'm doing that, I'm researching 2014. I have to do those simultaneously so that when I'm done writing 2013, I can immediately start work on 2014. Then as I start work on the book, I continue to research. So the research process is about an 18-month process. The actual writing process is about 12 months on that. So it's a very long process. When you write a book a year, as I do, there's always three in your brain constantly. At this particular moment in time, there's four in my brain because I now have to talk about Columbus. The Columbus book, see, I wrote it last year, so I haven't even thought about that book in a year. I turned it in a year ago. And so I've been writing another novel since then, which is going to come out next year. So I have to get that back in my head for the next month or so that I can talk about it. And then it'll pretty much be gone after that. But there's always three in my brain at all times, always up there. That's you have to learn to compartmentalize.
Certainly. That's a lot to juggle. Why write so far out, and why one a year? I mean, is that just a personal goal, or is your publisher really pushing you?
Well, the publisher has this nasty little rule that they won't give you a check unless you give them a book. So, you know, and so they I don't know why they won't give you a check without the book, but they require a book. So, and this is my living. This is how I make a living. So I do a book a year. I would love to do a book every 2 years, but unfortunately in today's market, you have to be careful about that because you can lose your audience fairly quickly. You know, until you reach a point where you become what we call a branded writer, where you're branded, you're like a Dan Brown or a David Baldacci or Jim Patterson or John Grisham, that type of thing. When you become a branded writer, it's a little different story. We're working on becoming that. It takes about, I don't know, somewhere between 12 and 15 books to pull it off, and we're getting to that point. Hopefully one day that'll happen and I can do a book every couple of years, but right now, I have to keep that book a year up to keep my audience happy and to keep things moving along.
You briefly described your protagonist in this book, Mr. Sagan. What was the inspiration for this failed journalist who is quickly embroiled into some sort of shady dealings going on overseas? I mean, where did this character come from?
Well, I read some stories about eight different journalists who were involved in some scandals that disgraceful, you know, where they were disgraced for fraud and faking stories and things like that. I read about eight or ten different people who were involved in that over the last 25, 30, 40 years. And so I got kind of a feel for it, of what it was, and then I just made him up. I mean, I just kind of made him up from there. So it wasn't modeled on anybody in particular. It was modeled on the concept of a journalist who did it. Now, in Tom's case, what's happened to him is not necessarily he was set up. He was basically destroyed.
Sure.
And And he knows that, but no one else knows that. He's the only person who knows he was basically set up and destroyed. And this book is a little bit about that redemption of that. And it also deals with his daughter, Allie. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of things in here for Tom. He changes as this book goes on. When you first meet him, he's very defeatist. He's about to die. And then when you finish up with him, he's a different kind of guy. And I like Tom. I enjoyed him a lot, and I'd love to bring him back one day.
He's definitely an intriguing character. We've only got a few seconds left. But advice for budding writers. I mean, clearly you have a lot of stick-to-itiveness, persistence in the writing field. What's your best advice for the writers out there?
Simplest in the world. You have to write every day. You have to keep writing. You have to write every day. Writing is a discipline. You got to sit yourself down. You got to do it every day. No one in the world can teach you how to write. There's no such thing as a writing teacher. But there are people that can help you teach you how to write. That's what I'll do in the workshop. I'm hoping I'll be that person that can help teach you how to teach you how to write. And you'll go back home and your eyes will be open. You'll be able to work on your craft. But you have to work on it every day. That workshop's going to be really cool. It's the first one we've done in Utah. It's my first trip there. You can find out all about it, too, not only at your website, but at steveberry.org. We have all the information up there where you can register for it. It happens at 8:30 Monday morning at the Utah Heritage Foundation Memorial House.
We're going to have to leave it there. Steve Berry, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And again, more information about both events at kcpw.org. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.